So, second part, as I said, I promise nothing new. We'll just go through some of the studies that have been done in the past 10 years or so using RNA-seq, so that we can reinforce some of the concepts that we look at this morning, as well as discuss what type of result have been achieved by using RNA-seq approaches. And mostly we'll focus on two set of papers, a couple of representative RNA-seq papers that describe what has been done in the context of the ENCODE project. And so we'll discuss what the ENCODE project is and what kind of studies have been done under this big umbrella. But those will not discuss them in details. We'll just go through them to see what kind of results have been achieved. And then we'll spend a little more time to look at your research paper for this unit, which is also coming from the ENCODE project. And I apologize, I opened it only yesterday, so I don't know if anyone has had time to look at it. We'll go through most of the main figures, and I'll discuss the part that I think may be more problematic. But then feel free to reach out if there are other parts of the paper that are not clear. I'm happy to discuss them again after the break or to just answer to individual questions. Okay, so the first paper is this one from the Bargi group, which probably represent the first big study by RNA-seq. It was published in Nature in 2008. And what they did was to use RNA-seq to analyze 15 different human tissue and cell lines and try to achieve the full description of the transcriptome of these 15 different samples. The main conclusion of this paper is that for the first time they reached the conclusion that almost 95% of the human genome goes under alternative splicing. And this was a huge result for that time, because until then it was thought that the alternative splicing was used for a much more limited part of the gene set. So this was the first time that people really were able to measure splicing junction for the transcriptome in different cell system, and they realized that the alternative splicing is much more profound and utilized than initially observed. So when you now read the result, you read the textbook, or you read about the fact that 90% of the human genes are alternatively spliced, this is the paper from which that conclusion was achieved. So this is one of the figures of the paper, and I thought I would show you because it's a good example of what we were discussing this morning in terms of how to read the data from RNA-seq in terms of alternative splicing, how to represent it, and what kind of new information can be achieved. So this is the CLC25A3 gene locus. This is a transporter that is present on the mitochondrial outer mitochondrial membrane, and I think it serves for the transport of phosphates, if I remember correctly. Anyway, prior to this study, there were two different isoforms that were known for this gene, and this AK0 whatever. So these were things that are that had been sequenced by single gene sequencing, reported to databases, and they had a database number. The difference between these two isoforms was that people thought that there was differential splicing between these two exons, exon 3A and exon 3B, so that sometimes it was present with one form, one exon, sometimes it was present with the other exon. The results of these RNA-seq analysis show that the situation is much more complex than initially imagined. And so here you see the result, the real data coming out of the RNA-seq experiment from different samples that come from different tissue. As I said, what they have done is to sequence 15 different samples which represent different cell lines but also different tissues. And so what they represent here is the expression of this transcript in four different tissues: testes, liver, skeletal muscle, and heart, right? And so if you look at the expression in the liver is where you see the expression that you could have expected. So you have expression of a transcript where you have expression of this exon which correspond to the 3B form, and then those other two. Then you see arcs that connect those exon, which indicate, as we have seen before with the splicing graph approach, it means that you can splice from this junction to this junction, and those are splicing junctions that have been confirmed by RNA-seq data. So do you understand what I mean with the fact that they have been confirmed? So it's not just that people have predicted that this splicing junction may happen, it's that they have actually seen them. So there were sequencing reads in the RNA-seq experiment that were splicing those two junctions. So if this is represented as an arc here, it means that there were sufficient number of reads in the RNA-seq experiment that map both here and here, so that they really confirmed in vivo that that splicing form exists. Okay? Now, if you start looking at the other tissue, you see that those situations don't really correspond to the alternative option, which is to have the 3A. The only tissue where you do see the alternative presence of these two exons is this one here, the heart, where you have exon 1 that can either splice into exon 3A, or if you follow the other arc, splice into exon 3B. As I said, these are confirmed splicing, so it means that really in vivo there are sequencing reads that splice in these two alternative ways. Then from this exon 3A, you can go to the other one as well as for this one. So these indicate that the heart is a situation where you have both isoforms that have been previously described, both the one with the 3A and the one with the 3B. The interesting information that you gain from this type of representation is that they are not equally represented. So if you look at the y-axis report, the logarithm of the reads, so the size of this peak gives you an indication of how expressed they are, how many reads they have identified. And so that has been reported into the thickness of the arc. The thicker the arc is, that means that isoform is more highly expressed. It's a preferred junction. And so if you see, you have much more reads of these isoforms than of these isoforms. And so this is represented as a thick arc or a thin arc. And so this shows you that in the heart, the preferred isoform is the 3A, but there is also expression of the 3B isoform. Completely different is the situation of the skeletal muscle and the testes. So if you look at the skeletal muscle, you see the expression of the long isoform with the 3A exon. You also see some expression of this 3B exon, but there is no splicing from exon 1. Sorry, probably this is exon 2 since they call this one 3. From exon 2 into exon 3B. So this indicates that this is not an alternative splicing, it's an alternative start site. So you have something, expression that can start from this exon here, so you don't have the beginning of the gene, you just start from here and you keep going. Same thing up here. You have expression of the first exon with splicing into the 3B, but then the 3B doesn't splice further on. So this is a short form that has only two exons. However, you also have alternative start from the 3A, which splices into the fourth and the fifth. So the testes has two completely different forms of transcript. A short one with the first two exons, and then a longer one that starts from 3A. So this is just an example. It's an interesting example because there are actually, if I remember correctly, mutation in the 3B. Let's see if it makes sense. No, probably in the 3A. So there have been reports of mutation in the 3A in human patients that associate with defect in heart and muscle. And so this is mitochondrial protein, so there are defects in mitochondrial respiration and ability of the heart to pump and produce enough energy. It is interesting to find that this exon is expressed only in these two tissues and not as much in the other, if any at all. And so that explains why the phenotype that was observed in human patients is related to muscle function and not to liver function or not to the reproductive system. Okay, so this is just one example. Imagine that this paper reports result of this kind for the whole genome. And so the amount of new splicing junction and new alternative transcript, it's huge. And so what they have done it is also to cluster all the new information that they have been able to identify and try to define how often certain splicing event happens compared to others. So is it every splicing event can happen with the same frequency? You can skip exon, use alternative exon, use alternative star site with the same frequency, or there are some of these events that are more common than others. And so this is what this table represents here. Lots of numbers. I split it in two so that we can look at it a little bit better. Don't focus that much on the number. The numbers are interesting because they give you an idea of the real number of new splicing junction and new events that have been discovered through this study. But what I think is interesting is the fact that they really go through each type of splicing event and they define based on the real data. As I said before, these are confirmed events that have been identified by real sequencing reads. They define how often these events happen. And so what they found is that the most common event happening is skipping of exons. Whereas if you compare, where is it? Here. Mutually exclusive exon. So this is kind of the situation that we were discussing before with the SLC transporter. What was initially thought was that was a case where there was a mutually exclusive choice of two different exons, either the 3A or the 3B. And so this would be a case like this, where you either splice into one or you splice into the other. So these are actually not very frequent events. If you look at it, you find them only in 4 times 10 to the third. Compared to other type of splicing events, such as skipping of exons, that are the most common ones. And so what they do is that they really go through each of the type of splicing, and they show you the type of sequencing reads that support their existence. So what they show is 3 type of reads: gray, red, and blue. If you see the gray area, the gray reads are the type of reads that are common between the two isoforms. So those cannot be used to define alternative events. Whereas the blue one and the red one are the type of reads that will support the existence of that particular type of splice junction. So in this case here, you see the red sequencing reads are those where you see both alignment to this exon and this exon, or things that align into this exon alone, or things that align between this and this. So the existence of all these 3 type of reads supports the existence in vivo of skipped exon results. Whereas if you have reads like the blue one that go from here to here, then this supports the existence of a form where the exon in the middle has been skipped. Make sense? Okay. And they just go through each of the type of alternative splicing events in the same way. So they look at how you can define whether there is a retained intron, and you find that where you have reads that align to the intron in addition to sequence that align on the side. They find something interesting, that is that these are very rare events. So it's not that common for cells to skip to retain an intron. It's something that occurs pretty rarely compared to other splicing events. And then same thing for other type. This is cases where you use an alternative splice site, so you have an exon that becomes a little bit longer because it also uses part of the intron, and so on and so forth. Okay, so these, so that's all about that first paper. Then lots of other data has been produced since then that has supported those type of results in terms of splicing event, as well as generated an all new description of the transcriptome in different tissues and different cells. And most of it has been produced under the ENCODE umbrella. So this is one of the paper. It's kind of like the the cover paper. So the ENCODE project, will go through what it is and what they did, but the ENCODE project ran for a number of years, and then in 2012, they published a huge number of data, and they did that by publishing 30 different papers at the same time, which analyzed different aspects of the project, reported different type of results. And this is the article that put them all together. So it's kind of an introductory article that was published in Nature. Many of the other 30 were published in Nature, but many others in other journals. But this was kind of like the flag article, which described the study, described the type of results, described the website where you could access all the results. And then depending on what you are interested in, you can go and read each of the different papers. So what does ENCODE stand for? ENCODE stands for Encyclopedia of DNA Elements. And the idea behind this project was basically what we defined at the beginning of this module yesterday as the goal of transcriptomic. So the main goal of this project was to identify and characterize all the functional elements present in the human genome sequence. And so this doesn't include only mRNA transcript, or in general RNA transcript, but includes also DNA element, includes chromatin modification, includes gene expression profiling, so a full encyclopedia of everything. A chapter of this encyclopedia is the transcriptome. So as part of this whole huge project, they also wanted to do exactly what we said yesterday. They wanted to get the full profile of transcriptomes in different cells and different tissues. So the project was funded by different institutions. And so actually, if you look at the... Actually, we can look at that later with the other paper. There are plenty of institutes represented within this project, not only American institute, but institute across the entire world. So there are a lot of American institutions, there are laboratories at Yale, Caltech, different American institutions, as well as the RIKEN Institute in Japan, the Singapore Genome Institute in Singapore, a couple of institutes in Switzerland, in Lausanne. So it's really lots of places in the UK. So different groups came together to go about this final goal, and that's why also the results were published as part of this large collection of papers, because all the different groups reported some of their results. It was divided in two phases. The first phase ran at the beginning of 2000, and the idea was to start small and see how it worked. And so they focused on about 1% of the genome, not the entire genome, but they started to run parallel analysis through RNA-seq, ChIP-seq, all kind of different approaches, by focusing on a small percentage of the genome. And then they reported the interesting observation that there was transcription that occurred everywhere through this area of the genome that they had analyzed, both where there was gene-rich regions, but also where it was gene-poor. So that was the first strong proof that the genome was really transcribed at a much higher percentage than initially thought. And so not only from the coding region, but also from all what was then described as the junk DNA, all the intergenic region which people were wondering what they were there for. So then, based on the good result of this first phase, the project was further funded and they went on. The next goal was to do the same, but for the whole genome. And so the second phase goes from 2007 to 2012, and the idea is to interrogate the whole human genome. And this is something from the ENCODE webpage, just to give you an idea of the sheer size of this project, which is abnormal. So the type of analysis that have been run are multiple. So as I said, the transcriptomic analysis is just one chapter, is the RNA sequences here. Is the goal is to find all the regions that are transcribed. But there are also the goal is also to define all the DNA methylation, the DNA methylome of the cell, the status of the chromatin, so look at chromatin modification in terms of chromatin accessibility, but also in terms of specific ChIP-seq for transcription factor, for histone marks, as well as look at RNA binding on the RNA that are transcribed. And this was done on a number of samples. So there are different cell types that have been analyzed, and so almost 150 cell types have been analyzed, and more now. This is at the end of the second phase of the project, with sequencing of more than 20, the whole spectrum of coding genes, RNA transcript, data sets, paper published, blah, blah, blah. This is the cost for the pilot experiment. The interesting thing is that the cell, obviously not everything has been done with every cell types. Cells have been divided in different tiers, and this is what is represented here. Tier 1, tier 2, tier 3. And so tier 1 are just a few cell lines for which every single experiment has been run. So those are the best characterized cell types. Then there are tier 2 for which only some of the analysis have been fully completed, and then tier 3 is everything else, is much less information about those cell types. And the goal, because the project is not ended, is to fill all these squares, right? And so get full profiling of, in theory, every cell type, every tissue, everything. Okay, so where can you go if you want to look at this type of data? And so I put here some of the website, and let's see if I manage to show you some of this. This is not the most user-friendly platform, but I'll try. Okay, so the first thing is, where do you find the description of all these project and the description of the encyclopedia? So that's the first website up there, the ENCODE project. And we can go here. Here, yes, okay. So this is the ENCODE website, and you can go browse through it. It basically describes, there is a section about the encyclopedia up here, that's the one I'm looking at, and that describes the type of information that they were trying to achieve about all this functional element present in the genome. And so you can see that you can access, through the ENCODE portal, you can access a lot of different type of data. You can look at the raw data, you can download the raw data if you are a bioinformatician and you want to reanalyze some of these results. You can look at the results of all the different ChIP-seq and RNA-seq experiment as they have been analyzed and aligned to the genome, as well as you can look at results that have been achieved by integrating some of these results one with another in order to be able to describe for each gene what are the transcripts, how are they regulated, where are the regulatory regions, and so on and so forth. Then if you click on matrix, you can look at the matrix. And so this represents what in the previous slide was represented by that tower with all the little gray square, right? So it shows you for each cell line and each tissue. So these are different cell lines, and you can see there are 196 more that you can look at. Here now there are also a lot of tissues that in the initial phase were not present. So you can see about 160 type of different tissues. And for each of them, if you go across, you can see that it's reported what type of assays have been run and what type of results you can look at. So, for example, these initial cell lines here are the one from TL1 for which most analyses have been run. And you can see that there is all kind of data. You can see there are almost 700 experiments for ChIP-seq data. There is chromatin accessibility. There is polyRNA-seq data, short RNA-seq data, total RNA-seq data. So those are all the type of things that we discussed this morning, right? There is not one single type of RNA-seq that you can run. And the results here are reported for all the different approaches. And depending on how they were run, they will lead to different type of results. You can also see some array data, small RNA-seq data, as well as one thing I wanted to point out is that there is a lot of cage data in the ENCODE project, because as we discussed this morning, even if things have proceeded and new technologies have been developed, cage is still a very important approach to determine the transcriptional start site of the genes. And so for many of these cells, cage has been run at the whole genome level. And then there is also some single cell RNA-seq data present there. This is pretty new. It wasn't there in the initial phase. And we'll discuss tomorrow what's the advantage of doing single cell RNA-seq data. But I would say this is where this is moving into, the fact that it's not enough to define things at the tissue level, but you also have to start considering single cells. Okay, so how do you visualize that? So one way to do it is to, those are all the websites that I listed on that page. One way to do it is to go to the UCSC web browser. This is one of the most common web browsers to visualize sequencing data. And through this browser, you can explore the ENCODE data, just go directly into each single experiment. Or you can go to the UCSC browser and look at them through this website, where you can focus on one particular cell types or experiment you are interested in, or you can look at them all together, and I'll get to that in a minute later. What I would like to spend a few minutes on is this webpage, because I think this is what is probably, the previous one are very useful for a researcher in the lab. You are interested in a certain gene, a certain question, and you can really go in into this web browser and interrogate them, try to find a lot of information without the need to run experiment at the bench. So if I'm interested in a certain gene, I can go there and see a lot of information about how the gene is expressed, where it's expressed, how it's modified, where the regulatory regions are, and so on and so forth. This website, instead, I think it's particularly interesting for everyone, but particularly for students, because what they did, so this is a website that Nature put together when these 30 papers were published, to try to summarize all these results and present them in a form that could be more accessible for the readers. So not necessarily only the users, but also readers of scientific journals that are interested in these results. And so if you go on the Nature ENCODE website, you see there are 13, I think, in general information. So you can find the type of pictures that I showed you before. You can click here and get all the information about what is ENCODE. You can read a guide to how to use this ENCODE Explorer. But more interestingly, you see there are all these threads. What these threads are, they correspond to what I showed you before, all the different type of analysis that are run within ENCODE. So transcriptomic is one of them, ChIP-seq is another one, open chromatin accessibility is another one. And so they present them in such a way that they give you a description of what they're trying to do, a description of the results. And so if you click on one, for example, it shows you what this thread is about. And this, for example, is about transcription factors. So if you read the thread, it tells you about transcription factors and what kind of information have been achieved through the ENCODE project. And it also sends you to the papers that have been published through ENCODE that really refer to that particular area. So those are this one here. You see my arrow here. So these papers here on the side are all those 30 papers that have been published all in 2012. But obviously not all of them are reporting data about every aspect of the ENCODE project. And so this is an easy way to go and look for the papers that are more interesting for you. And so I think if I remember correctly, the number three is, yes, number three is the characterization of intergenic regions and gene definition. So this is more related to what we have been doing together. And so if you can read the thread, and you can see that there is a description of the type of data that have been produced, and then it refers to the main papers in this area. And the main paper in this area, this landscape of transcription, is the one that you have as a research paper for this unit. So not only you can read the paper on your own, but you can also go here and read kind of a summary of the results and what kind of things have been looked at. And they also include other papers that are present in that particular thread, and you can decide to look at them if you're interested or not. So I would encourage you to play a little bit with this. It's an interesting way to look at what kind of results have been achieved and get some information about the type of data that is available out there. So there is chromatin modification around promoters. This is something we'll discuss next week. There is a regulation of RNA processing, non-coding RNA characterization. This is also related to some of the things that we have been discussed, DNA methylation, and so on and so forth. And for each of them, there is a specific web page and the discussion of some of the papers that are related to this topic. Okay, so this is the same thing, and this one we'll get there after. Okay, so the last point is just that this huge availability of data clearly indicate that there is the possibility of doing a lot of studies without even touching the bench, but just mining all this data that is already available that can be integrated. And this is true not only for the ENCODE database, but also for data that people publish. So whenever we run an RNA-seq experiment or a ChIP-seq experiment, we are required to deposit the data. So there are data repository. NIH will never fund you again if you don't deposit the data that you have produced with the previous funding cycle. And so people deposit the data, and then once the paper is published, at the end of each paper, you find the information about where the data is deposited. And so this means that anyone can go there, download the data, and reanalyze them. You can reanalyze them to ask different type of questions. It's possible that I published an experiment where I do an RNA-seq between two different tissues, and I'm interested in studying how metabolic genes are regulated. And that's how I focus on, and then I publish it, and It's there, it's deposited. And maybe you are not interested in the metabolic genes, but you are interested in how RNA splicing is regulated in that particular sample. And it's very easy to download the data without the need of regenerating it and analyzing it. And so there is an explosion of opportunities in terms of integrating data that is already available out there, because you can also combine results that have been produced in different laboratories and compare them, integrate them. Okay, so the third paper that I wanted to mention is this one, mostly to mention the fact that the ENCODE project expanded into other organisms. And so initially was focused on the human genome, and then it expanded to mouse genome as well. But then something else started, which is called the MODE ENCODE project. So the ENCODE project for model organism. And so right now there have been a lot of results published regarding mostly worm and fly, because those are the two most used model organism in different labs, where they have done kind of the same things. They have tried to achieve a full description of the transcriptome as well as other functional information about those type of of genomes, those type of organisms. And so one thing I would like to point out about this paper is that they this is 2011, so we are not talking about years and years and years ago. But they don't use only RNA-seq. What they use is a combination of complementary approaches. So they have used RNA-seq, they have used styling microarrays, and they also have used cDNA sequencing. And then they have put all this information together to achieve a full profiling of Drosophila, in this case, the Drosophila transcriptome. And the interesting thing is that they did it in 30 distinct developmental stages. So lot of Drosophila is probably the most well-studied model organism. Lots of things are known in terms of gene expression, of transcript, RNA regulation. However, by going in such depth at looking at different developmental stages and even comparing male versus female organism, they have been able to generate a lot of new data, new information that was unknown, and find things that were not expected. And so this just summarizes exactly what I just told you. So they isolated the RNA from 30 different stages of development, and this includes all kind of things. They include embryonic samples at different stage of development. They include adults of three different stages of different sex, so male and female. And then they run a number of complementary approaches. So they did tiling microarray, simply because there was already a lot of tiling microarray that had been produced and generated for the Drosophila genome. And then they added on top of that non-strand-specific poly-A RNA-seq using both single and pair end and 75 base pair reads. So based on what we discussed this morning, you know what the single end and paired end reads are. You know that 75 base pair reads is a longer read compared to the basic 36 base pair reads. And that they did that because they wanted to be able to map all the splicing junction. And then they also did some, not for all of them, but for some of them, they also did strand-specific RNA-seq. And so that helped to identify strand-specific transcription, as we discussed this morning. And in this case, they did it from ribosomal depleted RNA. So should be a terminology that now you are familiar with. So those are results that should be easy to understand. And the result it's pretty incredible, I think, considering what I just said, that Drosophila has been studied forever and a lot is known about how gene expression is regulated at all different stages of development. Despite that, About 2,000 new transcribed regions were identified that are not linked to any annotated genes. They found new small non-coding RNA, microRNA precursor, and so on and so forth. And I think this is an interesting example because this is the bithorax locus. So bithorax genes are homeodomain transcription factors that regulate development in Drosophila. Extremely well studied. This locus has been studied by so many groups, and all the genes have been cloned, identified, studied, because it's the locus that regulates the patterning of Drosophila during development. So a lot is known about OX genes. However, within this locus, this study managed to identify a completely new coding region that had been transcribed region that had been completely missed before, in between two genes that are highly studied. So the ABDA and the ABDB are highly studied. In between, there was a region that where people didn't know that there was anything transcribed from. There had been some mutation in this region that had a phenotype in Drosophila, and so that suggested that this could be some kind of regulatory region, but it was unknown whether there was any transcript. And it was missed probably for two reasons. One is that a lot of these, so if you look, these are the type of transcripts that have been deduced based on the RNA-seq data. And if you look at the expression of some of the exons, you can see they are expressed very, very little compared to the genes that are next door. So this is one of the reasons why probably these were missed, because they were very low expressed, and so they were below the detection of previous approaches. The other reason is because if you look carefully here, you see that this gene seem to be, this transcribed region, seem to be expressed in the male samples, but not in the female samples. And so this is one of those cases where it's a highly specific region. And in fact, I think the name they gave it is now male-specific something. And so, and then there is one different part of it that is, it's an antisense expression that is occurring only in the embryonic region. So this is an example where profiling things in different stages of development and different sexes led to the identification of a totally new transcribed region. And this is just a summary of the type of things that they look at. FlyBase is the database, the reference database for fly, for Drosophila. So these were the number of things that were known prior to this paper. And this is the new events that have been identified based on the Model ENCODE project. So in terms of exons, there is that many new, so these are the new events, about 2,000 new exons and blah, 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 blah. Alternative, all different type of alternative splice events that have been identified through this project. Okay, so this I think I already told you. All this data is available. It's required to be deposited in public database, and depending on the type of data, it's deposited in different database, but it's all publicly available. If you publish gene expression data, you submit it to the GEO. If you publish microarray data, you submit it to the ArrayExpress, and so on and so forth. There are also a lot of specialized database where you can find other kind of information. This is a useful resource, the NAR database. It's basically someone that, publish it. But it's basically something that is published on a recurrent schedule. I don't know if it is twice a year or every year, where they collect all the information about existing database, and they published what kind of database are available, what kind of data is deposited in these databases, how you can access to them, and so on and so forth. Okay, so this is a question, right? So do they all report the same thing? You have all these databases. Do they all have the same thing repeated over and over and over again? And the answer is no, but it's difficult to, I tried to see whether it was possible to make a table where you can say,
in this database you find this kind of information, in this database you find this other kind of information. It's a mix and match, and so the most common ones are the Ensemble, the NCBI, the UCSC Genome Browser that we just looked at, or the GeneCode Browser. We look at that a little bit more after. They all present things in a different way, and so what people usually do is that they look at all of them. At least they compare results. If not all of them, at least two or three of them. We are in the middle of trying to understand whether a gene has different splicing isoform, because I think it's important to understand that these things are important not only for this big description project, but they are really important for the everyday life in the lab, right? So we are studying a gene that is huge, and we are trying to use CRISPR to knock it out. And we keep having issues, depending on where we design the guide RNA, because it seems to be that it's deleted in some cells, but not in others, and then there are other forms that come up on the Western blot, and we don't know what they are. So we are trying to understand whether there are alternative isoforms, and by deleting, we are targeting only some isoform and not others. And this is the type of information that you can find on this database. And so that's exactly what we were doing the other week. We were comparing databases and trying to find, is there an isoform that is reported in one place that we cannot see in the other one? And can we use this data to figure out where we better design our guide so that we can knock out the genes? So I think this is one message that I would like to leave you with. These are not studies that are only important for this big project description, but they are something that really makes better the everyday life in the lab and allows you to proceed much faster, because there is a lot of data that is already out there. You can mine it, find what you're interested in, and then move on with your specific question, biological question. So just to give you an example of what these look like, let's see if I can do it quickly. Yeah, so this is the UCSC Genome Browser, so just one of those that you can interrogate. And if you are interested in a gene, you can just write the name of the gene here, right? And so GPS2 is probably the gene that we study the most in the lab. It's not the one I was talking about. And then this is the type of information that you can look at. So the first thing you see up here is the gene code results. So you can see, you can look at how many exons are present. You can look at whether there are alternative isoforms. You can also decide to look at them in a more complete way. Usually that can be. Or you can zoom out and look not only at that specific genes, but also at other genes that are in the same interval. And so here on the side is this other gene that we are interested in. This is Neuralize4. And you can see it's a complex gene. It has it's a very long gene with a lot of different exons. It has a couple of different isoforms that either have or not have this particular exon here. But there is also something that is confusing, that is what is called transcription that go through, how do you call it, run through transcription. So if you see here, there is this weird form which seems to be starting in the middle of this gene and then continue all the way into GPS2. And so that's one of the things we are trying to understand, whether this exists really in vivo or not, or whether it's something that has been observed in a certain specific tissue but not all the time, and whether it leads to a fusion protein or it's just an aberrant form of wrong transcription. And then you can also see some expression data. You can see some histone modification data that allow you to see where the promoters are, and we'll look at more of that in the future. You can see whether there is accessibility of the chromatin. These are DNA's clusters, so it shows you that here there is a DNA accessibility area as well as here, and these are consistent with having promoters, so having a region where the chromatin is open, and so on and so forth. if you look at the same gene, or if you choose any other gene, I'll show you this one just because I know it, but through the all the different through all these different genome browser, you can see how the same type of data is reported in a slightly different way, and how you can look at the transcript from a different perspective. You can find more information about the sequence of the specific transcript, those kind of information. So your homework, I was saying we don't give homework in the US, but your homework for, but just for fun. Try to look at one gene, choose the gene you like, can be this one or it can be anyone else. Try to look at it through the different database. I think it's useful for you to understand which kind of information you can find from this kind of databases. Okay? So, do you want to take a short break? Do you want to keep going and finish faster? Whatever you prefer. Keep going? Did I understand correctly? Yeah? But for me, I need to drink, but other than that, if you want to take a break, go ahead and take a break. Paper, and as I said, I'll mostly try to highlight the thing that I think could be a problem or they can be confusing, but feel free to reach out if you have more questions. So the first thing about this paper is that it probably reads more as a review than a research paper. So it should be, for some aspect, easier than a normal research paper to read. And the reason for this is because, as I said, this is one of the main paper from ENCODE. So the type of results they are reporting is more of a global description of things rather than discussing experiment one by one. And so what they are doing in this paper is they go through different chapters where they report the data about single topics. So I think it makes it a little bit easier to read. You should be able to follow it pretty easily. As you will see at the beginning, when you first look at the first page, it has a description of the ENCODE project, and it also shows you all the different institutes that have been involved in this project. It's a lot of different labs, so it's nothing that a single lab or a couple of labs could put together. And then the first thing that they do, the first chapter, is about the generation of the RNA data set. So they go through how they prepare the RNA and why they chose to do it in a certain way. And one thing to keep in mind is that, I don't know if you noticed it, when we read the description of what the ENCODE project is, it wasn't only a definition of the definition of all the functional parts, but also where all these components are in the cell. So there are two things that are trying to do here. They are trying to compile the set of all the transcript, but they are also trying to understand where these transcripts are, whether they are in the nucleus, the cytosol, where the different events are happening. So there is a general description of what they are, but there is also the attempt at looking at the intracellular localization. And so because of that, they prepare the RNA in a certain way. So this is nothing that we need to rediscuss, it's just a general description about the RNAs, the ENCODE, and so where the data that they are using come from. This is the data that we discussed before. And then here is the first chapter, is about the experimental setup. And so they describe the fact that they are looking at RNA from 15 different cell lines, and this is all about the ENCODE project, as we described before. But what is interesting for us is how they fractionate this RNA. So they look at fractionation between nucleares and cytosolic RNA. They separate the RNA based on length. Long RNA are more than 200 base pair. Short RNA are shorter than 200 base pair. And I hope you remember from earlier today when we discussed about fractionation, nothing magic about this 200 number. It's just a technical limitation of the preparation of the library for the RNA-seq. But that's how they discuss the results. So when you will see the result, you'll see they are divided in long RNA and short RNA, and this is based on this separation based on the threshold of 200 base pair. And then the long ones are further fractionated into poly A plus and poly A minus. And then all of them are subjected to a number of different analyses. There is RNA-seq, there is cage, as well as paired N tags to analyze the site of 5' and 3'. And so this is the graph that they use to show you how they generate the sample. You see that it's a flow chart that represents all the different steps. So they first divide the RNA between they separate the cell extract into cytosol and nuclear, so then they can isolate RNA separately from these two population. So they isolate the RNA from the nucleus separately, then the RNA from the cytosol. Then they separate based on size. And for the short one, they sequence them directly. For the long one, they separate between poly A plus and poly A minus. And Michele last year drew this picture to try to make this easier to remember. So the total RNA is separated between poly A plus and poly A minus based on oligo-DT beads. So you run the long RNA through a column that has oligo-DT. The RNAs with poly A will bind to the beads. The RNA without poly A will not bind to the beads. And so the first one that goes through, the flow through, is the poly A minus RNA, right? The one that cannot bind to the column. The one that has poly A stays bound to the column, and then you can do a low salt dilution to get it out. And this is a way to separate the two fractions, the poly A plus and the poly A minus. And then they can either do the ribosomal RNA depletion or not, depending on the samples, and then they sequence. Okay, so it's just about, yes?
Sorry, are they separated RNAs from the long amount of RNA?
How they do it?
Yes.
So they don't separate it. What they do is that they get rid of it. So there is a kit for the preparation of the RNA sample for RNA-seq when you prepare the cDNA library, that it's called ribodepletion, which will remove the ribosomal RNA. So you just get rid of it. It's just to reinforce, it's nothing that you cannot understand on your own. It's just to reinforce the fact that they don't do only RNA-seq, but they also do cage. And the purpose of doing cage in this context is to be able to identify the transcriptional star site. And so because of that, they were able to identify more than 60,000 transcriptional star sites in cells from tier 1 and tier 2 cell types. And those are the ones that have been sequenced through ENCODE. Okay, so then we get to the results. And so the first thing they look at, second chapter, is the landscape of the long RNA. And so try to annotate the transcript. And so they do this, as we discussed today, in two separate stages. First, they annotate things that are known. So they look at all the things that correspond to known databases. And then they annotate the new transcript based on the fact that there aren't existing transcript corresponding to the RNA-seq reads that they identify in the sequencing experiments. And so before we get that, one thing I thought we would discuss is what do they mean with gene code gene? So if you read the chapter about the RNA expression, the long RNA expression, you see that it starts with the gene code, gene and transcript annotation capture our current understanding of the poly A human transcriptome. So one thing you may wonder as you read the paper is, what is a gene code gene? Is this a different type of genes than what we normally call genes? And so I thought I would just briefly discuss what is gene code. Gene code is just a arm of the ENCODE project. So it's the bioinformatic arm. It's a project within ENCODE that aims at using all the data that has been generated through ENCODE to define genes. So that's why the name GeneCode. Okay? And so that you can annotate the genes in the genome based on the information that you are achieving through all these experiments. So it doesn't keep in consideration only the transcript, but it also uses all the other information. So let's say the chromatin modification information to help define the promoter area, to define where the open chromatin accessibility is. Combining this information together, they try to define the list of all the genes in the genome. And so when you look at databases like the one that we looked at before, where you see the different transcripts being drawn, often is done based on what is called the gene code reference annotation. And so this means that the annotation that you are using to call all these genes is the one that has been defined based on the gene code data. There are a couple of other, I don't know if I've included pictures for that. Yes, so there are other gene annotation projects that try to do the same thing. They use the data available to integrate them and define the genes in the genome. And so one is RIFE-seq, the other one is GeneCode, the third one is the UCSC. And the way in which these, they all reach more or less the same result. The difference is the way in which they integrate the data and which are the aspects that they focus on. So GeneCode, for example, combine the RNA-seq data and the ensemble models with things that have been manually annotated before, so all the cDNA and the ESC. Do you have a question?
When they talk about genes, they mean genes encoding proteins or everything that is transcribed?
Everything that is transcribed.
Okay.
Yeah. The others are just using a slightly different approach. So the UCSC gene, for example, look at the RIFE-seq model, but it also adds data from the EST that have been sequenced. There are a lot of EST data in databases, so they combine all this together to achieve the same result. So when you go back and try and do your assignment, choose a gene and look at it in the different database, you will see that sometimes you see the drawings defined as gene code, sometimes you see it defined as RefSeq, and most of the time they're absolutely the same thing because you achieve the same result by integrating these data sets in different ways. But it's important to know that they all refer to the same thing, which is trying to use all the omics data available to define transcribed regions. Because this paper used the GeneCode nomenclature, I included the GeneCode website. You can go and look at it. One thing it shows is that there are different releases of the GeneCode annotation, simply because the studies keep going, and so the annotation gets further and further integrated with the new data. And so each, I think, quarter, they have a new release of a new annotation reference database. So I think we are now about the 27 or 28 we are using now. And here it just describes what is the goal of ENCODE and what ENCODE is and how you define ENCODE genes. Everything we just said. And these show you how the GeneCode release keep changing. So this is the number of genes and the number of transcripts, and it shows you how the numbers keep increasing with every release that had been that is published. Obviously, you have a higher increase initially, and then slowly you kind of reach a plateau where you don't get as much new information from new sequencing. Okay, so let's go back to the paper. I just thought I would clarify these things because one of the figures is titled "A Large Majority of GeneCode Elements," and so one question may be what is GeneCode and why these are called GeneCode elements. So then the other thing they do is that they try to answer this question about the different subcellular localization of different RNAs. And so they have one chapter about the different subcompartments. And this is one of the figures in which they discuss this type of results. So this is figure one, where they are looking at the known transcript. So they are not annotating new transcript yet. They're just looking at what is known transcript. But they try to see how represented they are in the different fraction. And so I thought we could just look at it for a minute together, because it could be confusing in the way in which they describe the data. So each of these lanes represent one different subset of RNA. So the cell is when you sequence the RNA from the whole cell, not being fractionated. The nucleus is where you you are looking at the transcript from the nuclear fraction, the cytosol from the cytosolic fraction of RNA, and then cumulative is the sum of the nuclear and the cytosol, which should correspond to the whole cell extract, but obviously you are dealing with cell fractionation protocol where you could lose material in the process. So they consider all the different aspects. And then for each of them, they look at splice junction, they look at exon reads, transcript together, as well as genes. And what they represent in this graph is a couple of different things. So there is, they use the word cumulative. I think the confusion about this graph could be that they use the word cumulative in a couple of different ways. So here they're talking about cumulative in sense of nucleus plus cytosol RNA. If you look down here, they consider cumulative the poly A minus versus poly A plus fraction. So in green, they have the both of them together. In blue, they have only the poly A minus. In red, they have only the poly A plus fraction. But then within the graph, they also show a box plot distribution. You know what a box plot distribution is, right? Okay. So within the box plot, they show for each of these situations, they show the data across different cell types. So remember, this is a paper where they report results from 15 different cell lines. So they're not looking at one single cell type, they're looking at all of them, 15 together. And so the box plot represents the dispersion between the different cell lines. The dot on top of it is the cumulative data between all these different cell lines. So they show you both the dispersion as well as the cumulative data. And really what is interesting here is how some of these are differentially present in the different fractions. So for example, if you look at transcript, you can see that there is a big difference in the blue comparing the nucleus and the cytosol. So if you look at the red are poly A plus mRNA, so RNA that are transcribed and then translated. And so they are exported to the cytosol where they are translated, right? Very well known that you find mRNA, poly A mRNA, both in the nucleus and the cytosol. Nothing unexpected about that. In comparison, the blue one, it's most enriched in the nucleus. You find very little, if any, of it in the cytosol. And this is consistent with data existing in the literature that poly A minus RNA are not exported to the cytosol. They have mostly nuclear function. But it was it's probably the first time that this is reported on such a large scale and analyzed through different cell line in different conditions. Okay, the other figure that I think it's interesting to discuss about this subcellular separation is this one, where they look at they use the data that they have been able to generate by comparing the RNA from different subcellular locations. To ask a specific question, and the question is the splicing occurring in the nucleus at the same time as transcription, as many studies have suggested, or is the splicing occurring after the mRNA is exported in the cytosol? So there are two options, right? It's possible that you are transcribing all the mRNA, then the mRNA, the pre-processed RNA is transported in the cytosol, and then that's where the splicing occurs. And that's what it was initially thought. However, there are plenty of indication, and now it's well established, that splicing could be occurring at the same time as transcription happens. And so evidence of that were coming from the fact that splicing factors are found bound to the chromatin. They were found because spliced variants were found in the nucleus. And then here they say we have all this data that we can use to try to answer this question. And so they analyze the data in such a way that they can ask this question. And so what they do is to say, okay, we can look at all the transcript. We'll find different splicing junction. We'll find different splicing reads overlapping the splicing junction if the gene has already been spliced or not. If the gene has already been spliced, we'll find only the reads that the junction reads, the one that we discussed before, right? However, if the gene has not been spliced, you don't find those because you still have the intron in between. And so what they do is that they sequence, as we discussed before, RNA from the cytosol fraction, as well as RNA, in this case, not only from the nucleus, but associated with chromatin. So they isolate the RNA that is associated with chromatin, and then they sequence it. And then they look at how the spliced or non-spliced sequence reads are represented in these two compartments. Does that make sense? So these are non-spliced reads, right? Because if you find both intron as well as exon information in one read, it means that the gene has not yet been spliced. This one up here, instead, are splice reads. We'll find things that are overlapping to exons only if the gene has already been spliced. So those are called splice reads. If we find splice reads in the nucleus, it means that the splicing is already occurring in the nucleus. And so in order to give it, to represent it and give it a number, they use what they call the COSY index. I think COSY stands for complete splicing index or something like that. And here it shows you how they calculate. They basically measure the ratio between the spliced and the non-spliced forms. And so if the splicing has fully occurred, then you have only splice reads and non-splice reads. So you get a number one. If, on the other side, the splicing has not occurred yet, it's the reverse condition. You have only the non-spliced. You don't have the spliced one. And so you get zero. And so they represent the reads that they found across this ratio from 0 to 1. And the result is extremely interesting. And it's a proof that the splicing occur at the same time as transcription, because in the cytosol, they only find things that are fully spliced. So only transcript that have a COSY index of 1. So this means that there is none of these non-spliced reads. They are all spliced. And so once the transcript reached the cytosol, it's already been fully spliced. Whereas in the chromatin fraction, they find all kind of things in between, which suggests that the splicing is occurring on chromatin. And so you find a combination of spliced and non-spliced form. And then once the splice is finished, as transcription terminates, that's been exported out. This is not the only data that support the co-transcriptional regulation of splicing, but it's a pretty important piece of data in support of that model. Okay, so what else they look at? The other thing they look at is gene expression levels, so across different cell lines. So they look also at things from a quantitative perspective, how much all the transcripts are expressed across different cell lines. And so before we get to this, I think we should discuss this figure 3, which it's scary when you first look at it, but there is a logic to it. So let's see if we can break it down so that it makes a little more sense. So first of all, don't focus on the circles and the hems and these kind of things, but look at the single dots, okay? So first of all, what is represented here? What they represent here is the level of expression. So we're now looking at quantitation. They represent the level of expression either across in the cell, so total RNA-seq, or as a ratio between nuclear and cytosolic levels of RNA on this axis here, okay? So what this means is that these give you an idea of how much something is expressed. The more you go in this direction, the more expressed it is. The more you go towards the zero, the least expressed these transcripts are. On this axis, what it shows you is whether they are more expressed in the nucleus or the cytosol. No, vice versa, because it's a ratio. So this half down here, it's for things that are expressed mostly in the cytosol, more in the cytosol than in the nucleus, it's a ratio. It doesn't tell you where it's expressed. It tells you the ratio of the two things. Here, there are things that are more expressed in the nucleus than the cytosol. So if we start from the more simple results, first they represent a couple of genes, just to give you an idea of single genes. And so in red, it's represented an example of a protein coding gene, these genes acting G1. And so each of these red dots is the expression of the protein coding gene, not the gene, but the transcript, because here we are measuring transcript. So they look at where the transcript for this gene falls in their RNA-seq data. And what they see is that in different cell types, so these are embryonic stem cells, these are HeLa, these are UVEC, all these cell types, the actin G1 gene is found very highly expressed because it's on this side of the plot, so it means it's expressed highly, and it's mostly found in the cytosol rather than the nucleus. Which makes sense, it's a coding gene, it's highly expressed, so you find a lot of it in the cytosol where it's translated, right? Different situation is for the H9 in blue. This is not a protein coding, it's a long non-coding RNA. And this has a very variable expression. So sometimes you find it more enriched in the nucleus, sometimes you find it more in the cytosol, and there is also a very large spectrum of expression if you look at how much is expressed. So in NEHK cells, there is tons of this long-coding RNA. In HepG2 or UVEC cells, there is very little of it. And so this is an example of the fact that non-coding RNA are more cell type specific, and so they can be highly expressed in one place and very low expressed in another. Okay, so this is for one single gene, but think about the fact that they have run this type of analysis for every single gene in the genome, and for each of them, they have looked at multiple cell types as well as nucleus versus cytosol localization. So what they aim to do with this figure is to represent all this together, so tons of information in one plot. And to do that, they use this type of representation, which is called kernel density. Don't ask me the statistic behind it, because I wouldn't know it. But what is important, I think, is how to interpret the results. And so what this type of representation tells you is that it's how much of each genes, the percentage of genes that are found in a certain space. So imagine this, not in a flat 2D space, but imagine it in a 3D space. So it really looks like a mountain, right? And in this mountain, they have represented all the genes in orange that represent to protein coding. So same thing then for the ACT gene, but instead of representing one, they represent all of them, all the protein coding gene in the genome. And so what this mountain shows is that here, the peak of the mountain, it has a number, it's 0.5. So about 50% of all the protein coding genes are present in this space. If you go all the way to the end, this is 0.05. So it's about 5% of the genes are in this area. So that gives you a physical representation, in a way, of where the where all these transcripts are found, in terms of amount of gene expression as well as localization. So what this tells you, first of all, if you compare the large scale of the coding protein coding genes, or in blue the non-coding genes, or in green the new one, is first of things you can see from that is that the protein coding genes are much more highly expressed than non-coding genes, and these are also much more expressed than what they consider the novel intergenic, so the new things that they've identified through RNA-seq. And this makes sense. We have been able to dissect better coding genes, which are highly expressed, than non-coding, which are less expressed. But also, the ones that we are missing are the ones that are very low expressed, and that's why they are hard to detect. So nothing super surprising about this. The other interesting information about this plot is that you can look at how they are distributed against the x-axis, the y-axis, and so you can see that the coding transcripts are mostly found in the cytosol, which again makes sense considering they are translated. The non-coding transcripts are found in both locations, which also is interesting. There are transcripts that are non-coding, but they also are transported in the cytosol, as well as things that are found only in the nucleus. But mostly they are enriched in the nuclear. If you look at how the distribution is done, it's skewed towards the nuclear part. So there is much more non-coding in the nucleus than there is in the cytosol, because it's a limited amount of transcripts that are non-coding that are exported. And then what is new is that this class of transcript, the green one, not only are new, they've not been identified before, they've been identified through this study, but they also found that they're almost exclusively nuclear. So there is very little, there is about 15% of them that are found in the cytosolic space. Okay? Make sense? It's a complex figure, but I think that once you break it in pieces, it makes sense, and there is nothing totally unexpected about it. Okay, so this is, I think, the last piece of data that we should look at. And this is the expression. So remember earlier on we discussed about the quantitation of splicing isoforms. This is what they do, again, on a large scale. So they quantify each isoform for each different gene, and then they look at a couple of things. The first thing they look at is how many isoforms annotated per genes are. And so you could imagine different situations. You could imagine that each gene doesn't have more than 3-4 isoforms, or a situation where you have a huge spectrum from things that have a couple of isoforms to things that have 20 isoforms. And what they found is that there is a large variability. There are things that have only 2 or 3 isoforms, 5, as well as things that have 25 isoforms. But things stabilize. There is like a plateau here as well. And so generally they compare the number of isoforms that are annotated with the number of isoforms that are found expressed. Okay? So one thing is to say, look, go back to those splicing graphs that we looked at before. You can make all these different possible combinations. And there are, let's say, a gene that has 20 different possible splicing events that can happen that leads to 20 different isoforms. Okay? That's what has been annotated. But how many of them are expressed at the same time? In the same tissue or in the same cell? Are they all expressed at the same time? Or only one of them, two of them, three of them? Okay, so that's the kind of question they are asking. And so this shows you that the less isoform you have annotated, obviously the less you have expressed. If the gene doesn't have many isoforms, you cannot express tons of them. But even for the genes that are that have a lot of annotated isoforms, you usually express no more than 10-15 at each single time. Okay? And so this is just something that they have observed from their data. It's something that wasn't known before. You generally reach a plateau, and each gene is expressed, can express a few isoforms at the same time, but usually not more than 10-15. The other thing they look is if a gene express 4 or 5 different isoforms in a specific tissue, does it express them all at the same level or at different levels? And in a way, we have already answered this question for specific cases earlier when we looked at that example of the muscle, liver, heart. They were not, the different isoforms were not expressed at the same level. There was one that was expressed higher than another in a certain tissue, right? Again, here is the same thing. They just look at the whole transcriptome at once. And so what they observe is that usually, depending on the type of number of isoforms that they have per gene, there is one or two isoforms that are the one that have the higher expression level and the others that are minor isoform. And so this is just observing at the global level whether different isoforms can be specifically regulated, whether there is one that is the predominant one or not. So to go back for a minute to this, I realize I forgot to tell you one thing about this graph. So one thing that it shows here is that there is a very large range in the expression of transcript, the level of expression of transcript. So that's something that they look at. They ask whether all the transcripts are expressed more or less at the same level or whether there is a large variability. And what they observe is that there is a large variability. So if you go from -4 to +2 in logarithmic time scale, it means that there is about a million-fold difference in the range, right? And so this is what they discuss in the paper. What they say is that one of the conclusions they reach is that transcript range in the orders of 5 to 6 magnitude of expression. And this is something interesting. It had not been calculated before at this kind of levels. But it also raised a philosophical question of how this is possible, in the sense that it's not a big surprise that non-coding RNA are expressed at a low level. However, if you look at the numbers that we are talking about, and you compare that to what is the approximate expression level of a transcript if you consider one copy of RNA per cell, this is extremely low. So let me go back and describe this a little bit better, because I think this could be a confusing point. So there have been people who have quantified how many copies of RNA correspond to determine RPKM levels, okay? And the way in which they've done it is very simple. You can read the paper. They just have counted the cells that they used to extract RNA. So they had the number of cells they used to extract RNA. Then they took the RNA, they did the sequencing, they calculated the RPKM, and then just computed the number of RPKM that they come up with compared to the number of cells they started with. And so they realized that 1 to 4 RPKM generally approximate one copy of transcript per cell. Okay, so that's the basic assumption. They've done the calculation. I believe they've done it right. So that's the number you start with. So if you think that a value of 1 to 4 RPKM correspond to one copy per cell, what does it mean when something is in this phase, is way below 1 RPKM per cell? It's in the range of 0.01. It means that there is one copy every 100 cells, basically, just from a numerical calculation. So this is a weird result in a way, right? So it's a philosophical discussion. I don't have an answer for that, but it's something to keep in consideration. You can explain it in different ways. You can think that there are transcripts that are expressed for a very, very, very short time. And so they are expressed and they are immediately degraded. And when you do RNA-seq, you capture them in one out of 100 cells, because you capture the specific time points where that specific transcript is expressed. That raises a lot of question about whether these transcripts are functional. and this is something that has to be debated. Again, I don't have an answer. But if you think about it, something that is expressed for such a short time that you can capture it only once in a blue moon, and you have a copy each 100 cells, does it really have a functional role? Is it sufficient to have a functional role in terms of generating changes in gene expression or not? It's debatable. The other possibility is that within each of these cell population, you have actually subset of cells that look different. And so one of the problems of doing RNA-seq, as well as every other type of profiling from cell groups, is that in that population you have a lot of different cells. You can have cells that are at different stages of cell cycle. You can have cells that are slightly different time points. And so profiling the whole group together give you a general base level of expression, but doesn't tell you what's happening in each single cell. And so this is, in a way, what is behind the idea of single-cell RNA-seq, and we discuss that tomorrow. And that's why people in many conditions are trying to go towards single-cell RNA-seq. But this is an open problem. I think that probably until we don't really get to the point where we understand the transcriptome of single cells, we can't really answer what this problem really means. Okay, and I think with this we are more or less done, yes. So other things that they discuss are not complicated. They reach a number of conclusions about alternative transcription, and they discuss how many new transcriptional star sites have identified based on cage data. They present some results about short RNA, enhancer RNA, and I'll not discuss them because short RNA, we'll talk a little bit about that tomorrow, but enhancer RNA, we'll discuss them more in details in the module 4, because we'll look at what enhancers are and whether these enhancers mean anything or not. So if you have a question about that part of the paper, we can always rediscuss it when we get to talk about enhancer. And these are just the conclusion from this paper. They state them pretty well in the paper, so I don't think you need too much of a discussion about that. The main conclusion is that what they find is that about 70% of the genome is covered by transcript. And this was a big conclusion for this study, because before that, what we knew was how much of the genome was covered by genes, by coding genes, and it was very little. And so one of the big questions was, what about all the rest of the DNA, those famous junk DNA? Is it functional in any way or not? This paper confirmed things that had been observed, but on a much smaller scale, that indicated that the genome is pervasively transcribed. So most of the genome is actually transcribed. Then once we know that it's transcribed, the next big question is, what is it transcribed for? So I don't think that this is a conclusive result, in the sense that knowing that all these transcripts are there doesn't tell us what they are doing and whether they're functional or not. But we'll discuss more about that tomorrow. Okay, I think we survived these 4 hours. Let me know tomorrow if you have questions about anything that I have discussed in this couple of days, okay? I'm happy to repeat things if they were not clear enough.
dirmi una cosa.
Ma loro non hanno